perfection. Now then, here we have two lines, he would say to David in a cheery, almost rapturous voice, as if to have two lines were a rare fortune, something one could be proud of. David was gentle but dullish. Watching David's ears evolve a red glow, Ivanov foresaw he would often appear in David's dreams 30 or 40 years hence. Human dreams do not easily forget old grudges. Fair-haired and thin, wearing a yellow sleeveless jersey held close by a leather belt, with scarred naked knees and a wristwatch whose crystal was protected by a prison window grating, David sat at the table in a most uncomfortable position, and kept tapping his teeth with the blunt end of his fountain pen. He was doing badly at school, and it had become necessary to engage a private tutor. Let us now turn to the second line, Ivanov continued with the same studied cheeriness. He had taken his degree in geography, but his special knowledge could not be put to any use. Dead riches, a high-born pauper's magnificent manner. How beautiful, for instance, are ancient charts, viatic maps of the Romans, elongated, ornate, with snake-like marginal stripes representing canal-shaped seas, or those drawn in ancient Alexandria, with England and Ireland looking like two little sausages, or again, maps of medieval Christendom, crimson and grass-colored, with the Paradisian Orient at the top, and Jerusalem, the world's golden navel, in the center. Accounts of marvelous pilgrimages. That traveling monk comparing the Jordan to a little river in his native Chernigov. That envoy of the Tsar reaching a country where people strolled under yellow parasols. That merchant from Tver, picking his way through a dense jingle, his Russian for jungle, full of monkeys, to a torrid land ruled by a naked prince. The islet of the known universe keeps growing. New hesitant contours emerge from the fabulous mists. Slowly the globe disrobes. And lo, out of the remoteness beyond the seas looms South America's shoulder, and from their four corners blow fat-cheeked winds, one of them wearing spectacles. But let us forget the maps. Ivanov had many other joys and eccentricities. He was lanky, swarthy, none too young, with a permanent shadow cast on his face by a black beard that had once been permitted to grow for a long time, and had then been shaven off, at a barbershop in Serbia, his first stage of expatriation. The slightest indulgence made that shadow revive and begin to bristle. Throughout a dozen years of émigré life, mostly in Berlin, he had remained faithful to starched collars and cuffs. His deteriorating shirts had an outdated tongue in front to be buttoned to the top of his long underpants. Of late he had been obliged to wear constantly his old formal black suit with braid piping along the lapels, all his other clothes having rotted away. And occasionally, on an overcast day, in a forbearing light, it seemed to him that he was dressed with sober good taste. Some sort of flannel entrails were trying to escape from his necktie, and he was forced to trim off parts of them, but could not bring himself to excise them altogether. He would set out for his lesson with David at around 3 in the afternoon, with a somewhat unhinged bouncing gait, his head held high. He would inhale avidly the young air of the early summer, rolling his large Adam's apple, which in the course of the morning had already fledged. On one occasion, a youth in leather leggings attracted Ivanov's absent gaze from the opposite sidewalk by means of a soft whistle, and, throwing up his own chin, kept it up for a distance of a few steps. "Thou shouldst correct thy fellow man's oddities." Ivanov, however, misinterpreted that didactic mimicry, and, assuming that something was being pointed out to him overhead, looked trustingly even higher than was his wont. And indeed, three lovely cloudlets, holding each other by the hand, were drifting diagonally across the sky. The third one fell slowly behind, and its outline, and the outline of the friendly hand still stretched out to it, slowly lost their graceful significance. During those first warm days everything seemed beautiful and touching. The leggy little girls playing hopscotch on the sidewalk, the old men on the benches, the green confetti that sumptuous lindens scattered every time the air stretched its invisible limbs. He felt lonesome and stifled in black. He would take off his hat and stand still for a moment, looking around. Sometimes, as he looked at a chimney sweep, that indifferent carrier of other people's luck, whom women in passing touched with superstitious fingers, or at an airplane overtaking a cloud, Ivanov daydreamed about the many things that he would never get to know closer, about professions that he would never practice, about a parachute opening like a colossal Corolla, or the fleeting speckled world of automobile racers, about various images of happiness, about the pleasures of very rich people amid very picturesque natural surroundings. His thought fluttered and walked up and down the glass pane, which for as long as he lived would prevent him from having direct contact with the world. He had a passionate desire to experience everything, to attain and touch everything, to let the dappled voices, the bird calls, filter through his being, and to enter for a moment into a passerby's soul, as one enters the cool shade of a tree. His mind would be preoccupied with unsolvable problems. How and where do chimney sweeps wash after work? Has anything changed about that forest road in Russia that a moment ago he had recalled so vividly? When, at last, late as usual, he went up in the elevator, he would have a sensation of slowly growing, stretching upward, and, after his head had reached the sixth floor, of pulling up his legs like a swimmer. Then, having reverted to normal length, he would enter David's bright room. During lessons, David liked to fiddle with things, but otherwise remained fairly attentive. He had been raised abroad and spoke Russian with difficulty and boredom, and when faced with the necessity of expressing something important, or when talking to his mother, the Russian wife of a Berlin businessman, would immediately switch to German. Ivanov, whose knowledge of the local language was poor, expounded mathematics in Russian, while the textbook was, of course, in German, and this produced a certain amount of confusion. As he watched the boy's ears, edged with fair down, he tried to imagine the degree of tedium and detestation he must arouse in David, and this distressed him. He saw himself from the outside, a blotchy complexion, a feu du rasoir rash, a shiny black jacket, stains on its sleeve cuffs, and caught his own falsely animated tone, the throat-clearing noises he made, and even that sound which could not reach David, the blundering but dutiful beat of his long ailing heart. The lesson came to an end. The boy would hurry to show him something, such as an automobile catalogue, or a camera, or a cute little screw found in the street, and then Ivanov did his best to give proof of intelligent participation. But alas, he had never been on intimate terms with the secret fraternity of man-made things that goes under the name technology, and this or that inexact observation of his would make David fix him with puzzled pale gray eyes and quickly take back the object, which seemed to be whimpering in Ivanov's hands. And yet David was not untender. His indifference to the unusual could be explained, for I, too, reflected Ivanov, must have appeared to be a stolid and dryish lad, I who never shared with anyone my loves, my fancies, and fears. All that my childhood expressed was an excited little monologue addressed to itself. One might construct the following syllogism. A child is the most perfect type of humanity. David is a child. David is perfect. With such adorable eyes as he has, a boy cannot possibly keep thinking only about the prices of various mechanical gadgets, or about how to save enough trading stamps to obtain 50 pfennigs worth of free merchandise at the store. He must be saving up something else, too. Bright childish impressions whose paint remains on the fingertips of the mind. He keeps silent about it just as I kept silent. But if, several decades later, say in 1970, how they resemble telephone numbers those distant years, he will happen to see again that picture now hanging above his bed, Bonzo devouring a tennis ball. What a jolt he will feel! What light! What amazement at his own existence! Ivanov was not entirely wrong. David's eyes, indeed, were not devoid of a certain dreaminess, but it was the dreaminess of concealed mischief. Enters David's mother. She has yellow hair and a high-strung temperament. The day before she was studying Spanish. Today she subsists on orange juice. I would like to speak to you. Stay seated, please. Go away, David. The lesson is over. David, go. This is what I want to say. His vacation is coming soon. It would be appropriate to take him to the seaside. Regrettably, I shan't be able to go myself. Would you be willing to take him along? I trust you, and he listens to you. Above all, I want him to speak Russian more often. Actually, he's nothing but a little sportsman, as are all modern kids. Well, how do you look at it? With doubt? But Ivanov did not voice his doubt. He had last seen the sea in 1912, 18 years ago, when he was a university student. The resort was Hungerberg in the province of Estland. Pines, sand, silvery pale water far away. Oh, how long it took one to reach it, and then how long it took to reach up to one's knees. It would be the same Baltic Sea, but a different shore. However, the last time I went swimming was not at Hungerberg, but in the river Luga. Mujiks came running out of the water, frog-legged, hands crossed over their private parts, pudor agrestis. Their teeth chattered as they pulled on their shirts over their wet bodies. Nice to go bathing in the river toward evening, especially under a warm rain that makes silent circles, each spreading and encroaching upon the next, all over the water. But I like to feel underfoot the presence of the bottom. How hard to put on again one's socks and shoes without muddying the soles of one's feet. Water in one's ear. Keep hopping on one foot until it spills out like a tickly tear. The day of departure soon came. "You will be frightfully hot in those clothes," remarked David's mother by way of farewell as she glanced at Ivanov's black suit, worn in mourning for his other defunct things. The train was crowded, and his new soft collar, a slight compromise, a summer treat, turned gradually into a tight, clammy compress. Happy David, his hair neatly trimmed, with one small central tuft playing in the wind, his open-necked shirt aflutter, stood at the corridor window, peering out. And on curves the semicircles of the front cars would become visible, with the heads of passengers who leaned on the lowered frames. Then the train, its bell ringing, its elbows working ever so rapidly, straightened out again to enter a beech forest. The house was located at the rear of the little seaside town, a plain two-storied house with red currant shrubs in the yard, which a fence separated from the dusty road. A tawny bearded fisherman sat on a log, slitting his eyes in the low sun as he tarred his net. His wife led them upstairs. Terracotta floors, dwarf furniture. On the wall, a fair-sized fragment of an airplane propeller. "My husband used to work at the airport." Ivanov unpacked his scanty linen, his razor, and a dilapidated volume of Pushkin's works in the Panafidin edition. David freed from its net a varicolored ball that went jumping about and from sheer exuberance only just missed knocking a horned shell off its shelf. The landlady brought tea and some flounder. David was in a hurry. He could not wait to get a look at the sea. The sun had already begun to set. When they came down to the beach after a 15-minute walk, Ivanov instantly became conscious of an acute discomfort in his chest, a sudden tightness followed by a sudden void, and out on the smooth, smoke-blue sea a small boat looked black and appallingly alone. Its imprint began to appear on whatever he looked at, then dissolved in the air. Because now the dust of twilight dimmed everything around, it seemed to him that his eyesight was dulled, while his legs felt strangely weakened by the squeaky touch of the sand. From somewhere came the playing of an orchestra, and its every sound, muted by distance, seemed to be corked up. Breathing was difficult. David chose a spot on the beach and ordered a wicker cabana for the next day. The way back was uphill. Ivanov's heart now drifted away, then hurried back to perform anyhow what was expected of it, only to escape again. And through all this pain and anxiety, the nettles along the fences smelled of Hungerberg. David's white pajamas. For reasons of economy, Ivanov slept naked. At first, the earthen cold of the clean sheets made him feel even worse, but then repose brought relief. The moon groped its way to the washstand, selected there one facet of a tumbler, and started to crawl up the wall. On that and on the following nights, Ivanov thought vaguely of several matters at once, imagining, among other things, that the boy who slept in the bed next to his was his own son. 10 years before, in Serbia, the only woman he had ever loved, another man's wife, had become pregnant by him. She suffered a miscarriage and died the next night, delirium and praying. He would have had a son, a little fellow about David's age. When in the morning David prepared to pull on his swimming trunks, Ivanov was touched by the way his café au lait tan, already acquired on a Berlin lakeside, abruptly gave way to a childish whiteness below the waist. He was about to forbid the boy to go from house to beach with nothing on but those trunks, and was a little taken aback, and did not immediately give in when David began to argue with the whining intonations of German astonishment that he had done so at another resort, and that everyone did it. As to Ivanov, he languished on the beach in the sorrowful image of a city dweller. The sun, the sparkling blue, made him seasick. A hot tingling ran over the top of his head under his fedora. He felt as if he were being roasted alive. But he would not even dispense with his jacket, not only because, as is the case with many Russians, it would embarrass him to appear in his braces in the presence of ladies, but also because his shirt was too badly frayed. On the third day he suddenly gathered up his courage and, glancing furtively around from under his brows, took off his shoes. He settled at the bottom of a crater dug by David with a newspaper sheet spread under his elbow, and listened to the tight snapping of the gaudy flags, or else peered over the sandy brink with a kind of tender envy at 1,000 brown corpses felled in various attitudes by the sun. One girl was especially magnificent, as if cast in metal, tanned to the point of blackness, with amazingly light eyes, and with fingernails as pale as a monkey's. Looking at her, he tried to imagine what it felt like to be so sunbaked. On obtaining permission for a dip, David would noisily swim off while Ivanov walked to the edge of the surf to watch his charge, and to jump back whenever a wave spreading farther than its predecessors threatened to douse his trousers. He recalled a fellow student in Russia, a close friend of his, who had the knack of pitching pebbles so as to have them glance off the water's surface 2, 3, 4 times. But when he tried to demonstrate it to David, the projectile pierced the surface with a loud plop, and David laughed, and made a nice flat stone perform not 4, but at least 6 skips. A few days later, during a spell of absent-mindedness, his eyes had strayed and it was too late when he caught up with them, Ivanov read a postcard that David had begun writing to his mother and had left lying on the window ledge. David wrote that his tutor was probably ill, for he never went swimming. That very day, Ivanov took extraordinary measures. He acquired a black bathing suit, and on reaching the beach, hid in the cabana, undressed gingerly, and pulled on the cheap, shop-smelling stockinette garment. He had a moment of melancholy embarrassment when, pale-skinned and hairy-legged, he emerged into the sunlight. David, however, looked at him with approval. "Well," exclaimed Ivanov, with devil-may-care jauntiness, "here we go." He went in up to his knees, splashed some water on his head, then walked on with outspread arms, and the higher the water rose, the deadlier became the spasm that contracted his heart. At last, closing his ears with his thumbs and covering his eyes with the rest of his fingers, he immersed himself in a crouching position. The stabbing chill compelled him to get promptly out of the water. He lay down on the sand, shivering, and filled to the brim of his being with ghastly, unresolvable anguish. After a while the sun warmed him. He revived, but from then on forswore sea bathing. He felt too lazy to dress. When he closed his eyes tightly, optical spots glided against a red background. Martian canals kept intersecting, and the moment he parted his lids, the wet silver of the sun started to palpitate between his lashes. The inevitable took place. By evening, all those parts of his body that had been exposed turned into a symmetrical archipelago of fiery pain. "Today, instead of going to the beach, we shall take a walk in the woods," he said to the boy on the morrow. "Ach, nein," wailed David. "Too much sun is bad for the health," said Ivanov. "Oh, please," insisted David in great dismay. But Ivanov stood his ground. The forest was dense. Geometrid moths, matching the bark in coloration, flew off the tree trunks. Silent David walked reluctantly. "We should cherish the woods," Ivanov said in an attempt to divert his pupil. "It was the first habitat of man. One fine day, man left the jungle of primitive intimations for the sunlit glade of reason. Those bilberries appear to be ripe. You have my permission to taste them." "Why do you sulk? Try to understand. One should vary one's pleasures. And one should not overindulge in sea bathing. How often it happens that a careless bather dies of sunstroke or heart failure." Ivanov rubbed his unbearably burning and itching back against a tree trunk and continued pensively, "While admiring nature at a given locality, I cannot help thinking of countries that I shall never see. Try to imagine, David, that this is not Pomerania, but a Malayan forest. Look about you. You'll presently see the rarest of birds fly past. Prince Albert's paradise bird, whose head is adorned with a pair of long plumes consisting of blue oriflamme." "Ach, Kvatch," responded David dejectedly. "In Russian, you ought to say, Erunda. Of course, it's nonsense. We are not in the mountains of New Guinea. But the point is that with a bit of imagination, if, God forbid, you were someday to go blind or be imprisoned, or were merely forced to perform in appalling poverty some hopeless, distasteful task, you might remember this walk we are taking today in an ordinary forest as if it had been, how shall I say, fairy tale ecstasy." At sundown, dark pink clouds fluffed out above the sea. With the dulling of the sky, they seemed to rust, and a fisherman said it would rain tomorrow. But the morning turned out to be marvelous, and David kept urging his tutor to hurry. But Ivanov was not feeling well. He longed to stay in bed and think of remote and vague semi-events illumined by memory on only one side, of some pleasant smoke-gray things that might have happened once upon a time, or drifted past quite close to him in life's field of vision, or else had appeared to him in a recent dream. But it was impossible to concentrate on them. They all somehow slipped away to one side, half turning to him with a kind of friendly and mysterious slyness, but gliding away relentlessly, as do those transparent little knots that swim diagonally in the vitreous humor of the eye. Alas, he had to get up, to pull on his socks, so full of holes that they resembled lace mittens. Before leaving the house, he put on David's dark yellow sunglasses, and the sun swooned amid a sky dying a turquoise death, and the morning light upon the porch steps acquired a sunset tinge. David, his naked back amber-colored, ran ahead, and when Ivanov called to him, he shrugged his shoulders in irritation. "Do not run away," Ivanov said wearily. His horizon was narrowed by the glasses. He was afraid of a sudden automobile. The street sloped sleepily toward the sea. Little by little his eyes became used to the glasses, and he ceased to wonder at the sunny day's khaki uniform. At the turn of the street he suddenly half remembered something, something extraordinarily comforting and strange, but it immediately dissolved, and the turbulent sea air constricted his chest. The dusky flags flapped excitedly, pointing all in the same direction, though nothing was happening there yet. Here is the sand. Here is the dull splash of the sea. His ears felt plugged up, and when he inhaled through the nose, a rumble started in his head, and something bumped into a membranous dead end. "I've lived neither very long nor very well," reflected Ivanov. "Still, it would be a shame to complain. This alien world is beautiful, and I would feel happy right now if only I could recall that wonderful, wonderful..." What? What was it? He lowered himself onto the sand. David began busily repairing with a spade the sand wall, where it had crumbled slightly. "Is it hot or cool today?" asked Ivanov. "Somehow I cannot decide." Presently David threw down the spade and said, "I'll go for a swim." "Sit still for a moment," said Ivanov. "I must gather my thoughts. The sea will not run away." "Please, let me go," pleaded David. Ivanov raised himself on one elbow and surveyed the waves. They were large and humpbacked. Nobody was bathing at that spot. Only much farther to the left, a dozen orange-capped heads bobbed and were carried off to one side in unison. "Those waves," said Ivanov with a sigh, and then added, "You may paddle a little, but don't go beyond a sajen. A sajen equals about 2 meters. He sank his head, propping one cheek, grieving, computing indefinite measures of life, of pity, of happiness. His shoes were already full of sand. He took them off with slow hands, then was again lost in thought. And again those evasive little knots began to swim across his field of vision. And how he longed to recall. A sudden scream. Ivanov stood up. Amid yellow-blue waves, far from the shore, flitted David's face, and his open mouth was like a dark hole. He emitted a spluttering yell and vanished. A hand appeared for a moment and vanished too. Ivanov threw off his jacket. "I'm coming!" he shouted. "I'm coming! Hold on!" He splashed through the water, lost his footing. His ice-cold trousers stuck to his shins. It seemed to him that David's head came up again for an instant, then a wave surged, knocking off Ivanov's hat, blinding him. He wanted to take off his glasses, but his agitation, the cold, the numbing weakness, prevented him from doing so. He realized that in its retreat the wave had dragged him a long way from shore. He started to swim, trying to catch sight of David. He felt enclosed in a tight, painfully cold sack. His heart was straining unbearably. All at once a rapid something passed through him, a flash of fingers rippling over piano keys. And this was the very thing he had been trying to recall throughout the morning. He came out on a stretch of sand. Sand, sea, and air were of an odd, faded, opaque tint, and everything was perfectly still. Vaguely he reflected that twilight must have come, and that David had perished a long time ago. And he felt what he knew from earthly life, the poignant heat of tears. Trembling and bending toward the ashen sand, he wrapped himself tighter in the black cloak with the snake-shaped brass fastening that he had seen on a student friend a long, long time ago, on an autumn day, and he felt so sorry for David's mother and wondered what would he tell her. "It is not my fault. I did all I could to save him, but I am a poor swimmer, and I have a bad heart. And he drowned." But there was something amiss about these thoughts, and when he looked around once more and saw himself in the desolate mist all alone with no David beside him, he understood that if David was not with him, David was not dead. Only then were the clouded glasses removed. The dull mist immediately broke, blossomed with marvelous colors. All kinds of sounds burst forth, the rote of the sea, the clapping of the wind, human cries, and there was David standing, up to his ankles in bright water, not knowing what to do, shaking with fear, not daring to explain that he had not been drowning, that he had struggled in jest. And farther out people were diving, groping through the water, then looking at each other with bulging eyes, and diving anew, and returning empty-handed, while others shouted to them from the shore, advising them to search a little to the left. And a fellow with a Red Cross armband was running along the beach, and three men in sweaters were pushing into the water a boat grinding against the shingle, and a bewildered David was being led away by a fat woman in a pince-nez, the wife of a veterinarian who had been expected to arrive on Friday but had had to postpone his vacation. And the Baltic Sea sparkled from end to end, and in the thinned-out forest across a green country road, there lay, still breathing, freshly cut aspens, and a youth smeared with soot gradually turned white as he washed under the kitchen tap, and black parakeets flew above the eternal snows of the New Zealand mountains, and a fisherman, squinting in the sun, was solemnly predicting that not until the ninth day would the waves surrender the corpse.